Thank you. Thank you so much. Good evening, everybody. My name is Alea. I'm an alcoholic. Oh my God, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for, can you guys hear me okay? Thank you so much for giving me the honor to participate in my recovery and share with you my experience, strength, and hope. The sobriety here is just amazing to me, and I'm a little moved. I guess it's too late for me to go to the bathroom, huh? Maybe it's just nerves. I'm a French alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 2nd, 2003. I grew up in Paris, which is why I knew how to say bûche, which is the traditional festive Christmas cake. That's what we eat in France. The reason that I mentioned that I'm a French alcoholic is because I never had guilt around drinking. So there are advantages and disadvantages to that. And the advantage is that, well, there are advantages. The disadvantage is that when I hit a bottom, I didn't understand that I was hitting a bottom, and it never occurred to me that drug and alcohol use could be at the root of it, because substances had been my medicine. I'm not going to get into a drunkalogue unless, does anybody here, would anybody like to hear a drunkalogue? I didn't think so. Thank you, but I do have one in my back pocket if you want it or change your mind. So for me, alcohol was a medicine until unsavory things happened, and then I was like, eh, drinking is lame, pot's cool, because I didn't lose consciousness. I had a few blackouts. And it worked a long time for me, because in addition to being an alcoholic, I'm an Aspie. Does anybody not know what an Aspie is? Asperger's, yeah, it's an endearing term for people with Asperger's. I'm an Aspie. And so I had a lot of trouble as a child with social interaction. And it wasn't until I discovered alcohol and hashish, which is what we smoke. Am I allowed to talk about drugs at this meeting? Okay, thank you. I'm a very good girl, and I don't like to break rules openly. Thank you. My favorite words from a meeting, you're not alone. I am not alone. I found my people, and I'm so grateful for it. If you ever, you know, went on a trip, get your bags ready, because we're going to go on a little trip, because I'm a little weird. So, you know, I prayed before I came up here that my higher power would enable me to share something that might be of some use to somebody here. So if you get something out of what I say, don't thank me, thank my higher power. And if you don't like what I say, take it up with my higher power. If you're new, there are 1,000 flavors of sobriety. And if what I say doesn't resonate with you, I humbly ask for your indulgence, because this is only, I'm not a professional. I'm just a girl from Paris with a story. And I came here and I found tools that helped me. And I'm going to share what helped me with you. And it may not be what's right for you, but I guarantee you that if you come back, you will hear something from somebody that has exactly the right tool for you. So keep coming back, and I guess I'm going to just jump into it now. What happened for me is there came a point where my medicine stopped working for me, and I was put on pharmaceutical meds, which I had always, as a point of pride, been against all pharmaceutical medicine except for entertainment purposes. When I had surgery, I did not take the meds that would inhibit my recovery. I would take them once I was recovered for fun. And there was logic to that, somehow. But that's not entirely true. But I am an alcoholic, so please expect me to embellish on occasion. I only have 18 years. I'm still one of the youngest one of us. So, I did save my drugs for when I was feeling better, because I did have a pretty good threshold to pain, and, you know, why waste a good pain pill on pain? So it wasn't until my very good friend came to AA, and she had been put on Wellbutrin, and she went in altitude, this is what I was told, and had a lot to drink, and she went into psychosis and started channeling the Madonna, and for the months following, she would walk down the street talking to herself like a crazy person. And I had lost her months prior, and she called me, and she would say, "Alea, I hope you get a pinprick of light, a pinprick of light." And she was talking about AA, but I had never even heard of AA. You know, I was in my 30s. I had never even heard of AA. We don't have that in France. 98% of our population is alcoholic. We didn't drink for pleasure, we drank for survival, because water was not clean. That's what I was told. But, you know, it is an art. Alcohol is an art in Europe. So again, you know, when I got here, I was a very refined drinker. I knew the best tequila and the best buzz, and every tequila had its personality, and I could tell you about it ad infinitum. So when I came here, the point of this is just to say that I needed someone to give me permission to be an alcoholic, because remember, I'm a very good girl, and I didn't want to be a fraud. And when I came here, I was so empty emotionally. I just couldn't take another vapid conversation at, you know, the whiskey or whatever club, you know, or bar I was frequenting. And I was empty. I was completely empty inside. And, you know, you hear about people losing things, and I didn't think I lost anything, but the only reason I didn't lose anything is because I didn't have anything. And I didn't have anything because I had never been sober long enough to build anything. And all I ever wanted was to be able to commune with my fellows. And I grew up, you know, remember, I'm autistic, and I grew up feeling completely disconnected from everyone around me. And I didn't want to. I wanted desperately to be able to commune with you, but all the ideas that I had in my head about the stories you said about me, because I was very hated as a child. And let me tell you, you all probably know this, but the French are not kind. Well, the Parisians are not kind. In the south of France, they are kind. But children especially are not kind, and in Paris. And I just, those voices ran my life, and I projected those voices onto everyone I met. And, you know, here is where I turn into a cliche. I was unlovable, you know, and I didn't know that that was the problem, and I'd never had enough, I didn't know what being clear was because as far back as I can remember, I was changing the nature of my reality before I even had a drink. And I had a drink. Well, okay. There I go again. At 2.5 is when I had my first drunk. And I had gone. And so I really, you know, at a very young age, I learned how to change my reality on my own or with some help. So I met one of the people that my friend was hanging out with. His name was Frank Cherry, and he wrote the Grief Recovery Handbook. And he spent a lot of generous time talking to me, and he finally said, "Alea, if you have a bottle of tequila, are you powerless over to what it does to you?" And I'm like, "A whole bottle?" "Yes, Alea." "Maybe." "Then you're an alcoholic. You're powerless over alcohol. You can be one of us." "Really?" "Yes." That was my permission. I just, you know, I heard so many stories when I came with my friend of things that were, you know, now I just say I'm a garden variety alcoholic because, you know, I didn't have that string that you know, for that first drink. Again, I'm from France, so this is what I grew up seeing. You know, you gotta get that first drink in somewhere, somehow, at the cafe at 7 o'clock in the morning where I would get my coffee before going to school, you know? I just didn't understand the different varieties of alcoholism, and there are 1,000 ways to be an alcoholic. I have met people here that were alcoholic, that were once a year drinkers, but boy, when they drank. And there are 1,000 ways to get sober. So I came in and I was shaking and I was late, as was my habit, for a meeting that I was going for the first time by myself. And there was a lovely woman in the parking lot by the name of Debbie, who tends to be chronically late, who found me and asked me if I was going to AA, and I said, and she's like, "Follow me, I'll take you in." And she held my hand in, and she, you know, then we all went out to lunch, and she just held my hand from that day forth. She just never let it go. And she cooked once a week and then had me over, and we talked and learned about this program, and we'd have this 11th step meeting where we would just, you know, we were all very mystical and we loved the 11th step. And, you know, I kind of started with that was my gateway to AA, was the 11th step, because I had always enjoyed connecting with other realms. And I feel like I'm talking about a different person now. It feels, I have died hundreds of times in this program, hundreds of times. And one of the tools that I used on the last one, because the first deaths were incredibly painful for me, but the last one was really beautiful. And what I did is, I'd heard in a class that if anybody here takes yoga, there's a pose at the end called Shavasana, and it's the corpse pose. And it was explained to me that the corpse pose is when you practice dying. You take everything that you've learned on the mat and you release it all, and wherever you are is good enough. And you let go, and you learn to die. You practice letting go, because learning to die is the most important thing that we can. All of us here have died to our old way of life, and we die daily to our old way of thinking. And the sooner we learn how to die, the happier and more quickly we get to the painless and happy, joyous, and free part of recovery. But dying when you're not practiced is difficult, especially when we're ruled by what's been, you know, commonly called the ego, who is not bad, but whose primary function is to keep you alive. So the ego is really just doing its job when it doesn't want you to die. But we have to learn how to let go, and we have to learn how to die so that we can live and be reborn. And we were talking about the principles of alchemy. You know, and I really do believe that this program is magical. And, you know, the ether and vapor getting hot enough and uncomfortable enough to let go and let an old part of ourself die. You know, a lot of us come in here suicidal because we want the pain to stop. We don't want to die. We want the part of us that's sick to let go and go into the light. And so in the last, what in my own terminology I call dark night of the soul, I had learned, and I had read this book, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, written by, you know, a Rinpoche, Sojao Rinpoche, where they were talking about, you know, learning how to die, visualizing yourself die as a meditation. It, you know, I read about it, but it didn't sink. But when she said that, something really stuck. And when I got uncomfortable, you know, we're taught to pause. And I literally, I went to my bed, and I would lie on the bed or on the floor or wherever I could, and I would just let myself die. And whatever it was that was going through my head at that moment, I would say, in 5 minutes, I will be done. I'm out of here. And it gave me the relief that I needed, that I would get, you know, because when we're checking out, sometimes, you know, we drink for 1,000 reasons. We don't even need a reason to drink. But when we're living, sometimes we need a break from what tortures us. And so I learned to, you know, that was one of the ways, that was the most effective way to pause that I practiced in my sobriety. Oh, by the way, five years. Where are you? I know you're over there somewhere. 5 years, are you still in the room? Did you hear the pop? Did you hear the pop? Not yet? You will. You know what the pop is? You do, but you haven't heard it yet. Give it 5 minutes. It'll come. It'll come. It was amazing. I heard the pop at 5 years, but not at 5 years precisely. At 5 years and 10 days, I was like, pop. I'm like, oh, wow. You all know what I'm talking about. If anybody doesn't know about the pop, I'll tell you about it later. So, different kind of pop. I was talking about dying, different pop, but it is a pop, like, you know, being birthed, I guess, is another pop. I was talking, it was very interesting, because one of the things that I was discussing with some people that I work with is the secondary gain of character defects. And I'd like to take a moment to examine character defects in the sense that my sponsor taught me very early on that our part is not our fault. And so, to me, AA is a very scientific program in the sense that if we do it in the ways that have worked for so many of us, we learn to look at ourselves with a kind of detachment where words like good and bad tend to become more things that work for you and things that are not working for you in your life. And so character defects doesn't mean we're bad. Character defects means that we have something that we learned as a tool and which worked for us because that was what our best thinking would do for us given our circumstances, and they no longer produce desirable results because we lose somebody we love because of a way that we behaved that we thought was going to protect us from something bad that happened and that might have worked, might not have, but at least gave us the illusion that we had some control over our uncontrollable, unmanageable lives. And so then I was speaking on this very day with another person that we like to ponder sobriety together and the nature of sobriety, and who had hit a bottom with their character defect, with a character defect, and rattled off a whole bunch of them. And he was like, well, what do I do with it? And, you know, it's not a bam, 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 we're done. Take a tote. Feeling's gone. It doesn't work like that in sobriety. We have several steps. It's in God's time. We hear a lot about God's time. And so it's like, well, now, you know, discover, discard. You know, now that you see it, then we have a step where we become willing. And then we humbly ask, then we're entirely ready before we ask for God to remove that defect of character. So once we've taken an inventory, you know, so I came in, my life was completely unmanageable. I had a higher power. I had a good relationship with my higher power. But what I didn't have was faith that works, which is something straight out of one of our books. So even though I had a very deep connection with my higher power, I didn't have faith that works because there was no structure to my faith. So I came here and I learned a faith that works. And I turned, and also I never had enough, and while I had this experience, I didn't have faith because I was riddled with fear. So it took me, I had to circle back to three before I could learn how to turn my will in my life. With my intellect, I certainly did turn my will in my life over to the care of God and Alcoholics Anonymous and the lovely people I met in here. Absolutely, I did. But it took another probably... It wasn't until my 12th year in sobriety where I felt safe enough to even experience gratitude on a deeper level. Oh yeah, I had surface gratitude if you took me to dinner or something like that, but like deep gratitude for the good in my life, I was too scared to ever acknowledge any good in my life because I was afraid that the minute I acknowledged it, I would lose it. Forget sharing it. Because if I admitted that something was good in my life, it was going to be gone. So, you know, for me, it was definitely sobriety. That's something else I heard a lot. However, I never realized it was sobriety until I looked at it in hindsight. Because when I was in it, it felt like the progress was, you know, I was getting better all the time and it felt like a lot was happening. And even though I was going through, my early sobriety was torturous. But my life had been so torturous. Now I had a group of people that actually cared about me that I could share it with. And somehow it made it easier and it kept me coming back. You all kept me coming back. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't be sober. because I couldn't, and myself alone with God couldn't. God brought me to you because only through all of you could God get enough of God inside of me to fill the God-sized hole that I had in my life, in my heart, and in my life. And so we were talking about, you know, I'm going to talk about my defect of character, but I'm going to share with you what I was sharing with my friend who's newer in sobriety. And how do you become ready when you're not ready? So what I like to do when I look at a defect of character, for instance, perfectionism, is what is the secondary gain of this defect of character? Well, I can think of one or two secondary gains. For one, when I came into these rooms, I didn't have any tools for self-care, and my body was in chronic pain. And through my perfectionism, I was able to finally build enough to be able to go to places where I could learn techniques of alignment that enabled me to become pain-free. That and getting rid of alcohol and inflammatory substances that create chronic pain in your body. Nonetheless, that's a pretty good thing with perfection. You know, that's like my perfectionism is protecting me, giving me good things. And then I thought, I got inspired all of a sudden, and I thought, wow, because, you know, of course, when I'm looking at a defective character, I pray and I'm like, God, you know, does anybody not know the set-aside prayer? Oh, you guys are so amazing. So I do the set-aside prayer for a new understanding of something that I've just uncovered to start the process of discovery. And I realized, well, there's self, can I have self-love? And can I have precision and clarity without perfectionism? And what is the difference? So, new character defect. Confusion. I have a lot of confusion based on ideas and thinking that I know what something means when in fact I don't. Or there might be another way to look at it, and I may be confused about something. So assuming that I know that what something is and wanting to get through it too fast to be done with it. You know, let me race toward my grave. oh boy, I don't know where that came from. I guess it's just, you know, happy, joyous, and free. These things that I couldn't joke about before are now, you know, lovely to me. So I take the time now to say, okay, well, can I imagine a world in which I don't have to achieve perfection to head in the direction of a desired outcome? The other thing that I realized about perfectionism in working with this character defect is that perfectionism is a way of morbid reflection, because it is sticking to an idea that I created in a past self that might have been an ideal in that time, but with the evolution of society, and, you know, all of us here have seen how fast society has evolved in a very short amount of time. What was, you know, like I used to have to, you know, this is not an original joke, but I used to have to get up and go to the telephone to pick it up and answer it. And if I wasn't there and I missed a call, it was gone. There were no answering machines. So, I can't leave my phone or I will miss my beloved forever does not apply in this day and age. So my idea of being the perfect mate has not one leg to stand on in modern day. I can let go of that. That technology is dead and gone. You know, so, I mean, it's a dumb example, obviously, but this idea of what perfection is, if we don't allow it to evolve, then what is this, you know, what is the perfectionism that I am trying to achieve? So before I can ask God to remove my perfectionism, I ask God to remove my confusion about perfectionism, so that when I think of releasing perfectionism, I don't get a lump in my stomach that says, but wait, it saved your body from chronic pain because of that desire, you know, because you were willing to not go beyond your range of motion and create further injury, and you learned how to be honest about your range of motion. Okay, we can agree that, so this is the clarity that we get in AA. We learn what's what. And so then I can label and reframe perfectionism not to mean self-care, not to mean self-love, but to mean that to which an ideal present or past or future of which I have no knowledge that I think I should be, which I'm not. That's what I'm going to call perfectionism. That's going to be my definition. And this is between me, God, my sponsor, and whomever I'm working with that is my, you know, one of you here that is helping me. And then I think, okay, so I go through my body and scan my body to see if there's anywhere that I feel resistance to letting go of perfectionism. Is there anything I think about perfectionism that's going to keep me from releasing it? Is, you know, anything that I see in the world, you know, so, and I ask God's grace to come through and bless my thinking, bless my perception, my vision, so that I wish to attain is God's vision and not self-will. Because I will also further to my little box of what perfectionism means, to the self-will category, what I think I should be. And then I go through so that it's like, how do I express myself? What words do I use that further nourish my need for perfection? Where do I say things? How do I frame things in the way that I speak to myself that's going to keep me from being able to release this character defect, this clinging and grasping to an idea, this rigidity? How do I express myself in ways that do not allow for evolution and change? Where do I cling to things being this way? And again, you know, there are a lot of contradictions in the program. Pause, but get into action. You know, we use discrimination because God gave us, you know, brains to use, right? I don't know, maybe that's not the exact quote, but you know what I mean. Then I go into my heart, and it's like, where in my heart does it hurt to not be perfect? What in my emotions, and where in my love does falling short? What does it mean to my heart? What in my heart would keep me from releasing my need to be perfect? And I ask for what I call God, whatever that is. You know, I'm going to take a quick little aside here. And, you know, people think of Hinduism as being a polytheistic. Somebody help me, please. Polytheistic. I'm French. Sometimes I have trouble with American words. Yes, I can speak with a very French accent. But you have to pay me money for that. Because I paid a lot of money to get rid of it. I'm sorry. It's my nerves. Polytheistic. Excuses, excuses. See? Demon of perfectionism. You know, where do I feel unlovable if I'm not what I think you think I should be? And can I just let go of all of that? And then I go into, you know, this space that, you know, oh, polytheistic religion. Sorry, I forgot my aside. You know, they tend to think of it as that way, but in the Hindu religion, there is this supreme being that is all, that is the Atma or the Atman, I think it's Atma, which is beyond descriptions, much like in Judaism, you know, Yahweh. And all the other gods come out of that, because you cannot conceive of what God is as a whole. So you have to kind of break it down into different colors in order to be able to kind of shift and make use of the divine qualities that you require in your life at that moment. So, you know, I go into, so then I go to, you know, my power center, you know, above my belly button. And it's like, where does this idea of being perfect and perfectionism, how is that tied into my sense of personal power and identity? And if I let go of perfectionism, then who am I? How am I, like, who am I if I'm not trying to be and reach this goal? And can I allow myself to be scientific and say, hey, who am I? If I'm not, like, if I'm free from this, who can I be? There's a bigger process, but I'm just kind of trying to get through it. And I go through, then I go through, you know, the space in my, below my belly button, and it's like, okay, where do I get that feeling in the pit of my stomach that I get from, you know, the way I relate to the world and relationships and my friends? And if I'm not perfect, will I still be loved? Will I still be worthy of the people that I think are so perfect around me? Because you all are always perfect to me. And you know, and I don't. And then it's like my life force. If I go to the root of my being, the, you know, the very bottom of my spine, the root of my life force, will I survive if I let go of perfectionism? Will I die? Will this physical form die because I'm not cautious enough? Because I didn't work hard enough? And if I don't answer yes to that, then I pray and I call what I call God's grace, and I imagine a light come through and just wash me clean, and just keep thinking of this light coming through me and clearing all of these obscurations, and turning it over and asking God to remove that which is in the way of my being willing to release this. But only after I've examined it and felt authentically, do I feel a resistance, or am I ready to let it go? Because sometimes I'm ready right then and there. And what I like to say, I like to think of, you know, this, what we do in this program is, you know, we exercise neuroplasticity, and we learn to rebuild, you know, we rehabilitate the freeways in our mind that take us from point A to point B. And we bring, you know, a brand new freeway without potholes that just you can... And so how do we do that? So I call in for help, you know, to be washed clean of old ideas. And I like to use this verbiage. I say, you know, I think of it as a supercomputer, because we really are. I learned recently that every one of our cells carries a 1.9 volt charge. So, like, if we learn how to access the power that is within us, we could basically give everyone in the world electricity for free. That's how much power is inside our very cells. That is one of, you know, that's the life force that animates us and keeps us, our hearts pumping while we're sleeping. That intelligence, I call on that. I call on that experience of love that makes me, you know, that I always label, it feels like Christmas even when it's July, you know, that just that love, that feeling of love, that's one of the ways I like to see my higher power. So I call upon these principles whichever one feels most adequate to the situation. And perfectionism, I would say intelligence, love, you know, truth. If I let go of this, what is the truth? What is God's will for me? You know, what is the truth that will set me free, make me happy, joyous, and free, and put me on the road of happy destiny? Because that's how I've come to define God's will for me. That which will take me to the road of happy destiny. And it took a lot. Did you see my body just deflate when I said that? And that's like the tip of the iceberg. It took a lot. I'm trying to not be melodramatic. You are so kind to laugh at my jokes. I'm not a professional. It takes a lot for me to let go of the fear, you know? And so I think of this supercomputer, this intelligence, and I ask it to, you know, and just as if I were in front of my computer and I look at a file and it's taking up space and I need it, you know, because with all the video and experience that I have and fun things I want to put on it, I don't need these old files that remind me of nothing I'll ever look at again, and I just hit delete. So I say delete. I give it to God, and when I ask God to remove it, it's not so much I'm begging God to remove it, I think of it as God wants to take it from me, and I'm going to give permission to God to take it. I'm just going to let it go. I don't have to push it out. Oh, thank you. Am I done, or is it 5 minutes? So I say delete. What I say to myself is like, okay, whatever is in the way after I go through this, and I go through one center at a time, one part of my body at a time, and I ask myself, and I'm like, you know, anything in the way of this complete release of this, that which I have come to realize that I'm ready to let go of, that is labeled as perfectionism, delete, destroy, and uncreate it all. What would it take for me to live a life free to redefine myself as God inspires me? And anything in the way of that, delete, destroy, uncreate it all. And I'm going to quickly go over what that means for me. What that means is delete it, poof, gone. Destory. Take the memory, all of the story that is around it, all of that stuff in the fourth step, because, you know, I'm like this because blah, 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 and I'm a perfectionist because, you know, mother, narcissist, pain, I'm never enough, I'm an alcoholic, blah, 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 blah. De-story, take the story out of it. Take the story away. I don't need those stories anymore because I'm gonna write a new story. De-story, uncreate it. There was a seed moment when that was created. That will have been discovered in the fourth step. Uncreate it. That no longer exists because my perception changed. So I get to uncreate that moment because it is scientific fact, and I don't have time to get into it, but it is a scientific fact that you can change the past in your body. So does it really exist if you change it? Or the effects that it has on your health and your body? Uncreate it all across all dimensions, my brain, my feelings, my speech, my vision, the way I perceive, all dimensions of my realities, across all dimensions, times, childhood, all different timelines, all different, across all dimensions, times, space, wherever I was, wherever I am, from here on out, in reality, what my reality is today. This is my time, I'm sure. Thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for allowing me to just kind of go all over the place. And thank you for my sobriety.